welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. Remember, every dollar they spend on something they have no authority to spend on. I mean, even the DOD, even though we look at the Constitution or national defense and so forth to being legitimate, most of the DOD that they're spending, because they've configured it illegitimately, like spending money on the Army being overseas and the operations of the Army and the Air Force overseas, that's fraud, folks. The concept of deploying the national army off U.S. soil is not in the Constitution. Go look. The federalized army is only to function within the boundaries of the United States. So when I say fraud, the dollars being borrowed and the dollars that are being spent, when we look at the legitimate expenses, there's never been a year other than war, a legitimate big war like Vietnam, going back to Korea, going back to World War II, where we did take on debt. But we paid those things off. The illegitimate debt is where they've been siphoning off and basically continually racking up more and more debt. This goes all the way back to when they started trying to buy prosperity for America under Wilson and even before that. But even then, they were capable of staying on top of the debt. So they had to come up with schemes of spending more and more money, which is what they've been doing. And that is all fraud, because the money they're spending, they have no authority to spend. Ergo, fraud. So when we audit the books, I am 100% confident that if we go all the way back, the lingering debt that they've been accumulating, we don't know that. And when we look at the money that they brought and took out of your hides, your grandparents' hides, going all the way back well over a century, almost a century and a half, or even maybe a little more, we can start seeing that, wow, you know, they've been stealing from us. And now we need to get our money back. And so we need to start broadcasting, hey, world, you owe us money. Because you've corrupted, or our corrupt politicians worked with your corrupt politicians to steal our inheritance. Now, I'm on the record of saying I really don't care about that. All I care about is getting right, not taking on fraud, not spending money that we don't have, and let's get America right. We can worry about getting that money back through the proper means once we've got our feet really locked underneath us once again. And with that, welcome back, Sean. I still need a couple of obligatories. Obviously, I don't want to marginalize the importance of the appeal to heaven with Learn, Pray, and Act. And it's all about constitutional compliance. But on top of that, we were talking about the Electoral College that we didn't get a chance to close out for Article 2. So you probably have some questions that probably have popped up, because I know this is difficult to understand. Why did they even do the Electoral College? And I'll offer you this, folks. In 1787, they couldn't fathom how a Joe American, you know, any average guy from hometown USA, how he could run a campaign to become president of the United States at his own expense and in this impossible journey of traveling around the 13 states that's growing into, by the end of that century, I think we had 15 states or 16 states. And as it got bigger and bigger, the harder it would be to run a campaign in all of the United States. Now, does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So just
even more so now.
Yeah, well, because we have much more efficient travel. I mean, you can get to the East Coast, West Coast in, you know, a couple of hours. But to get from one city to the next city would take a couple of days, maybe, major cities. So to actually travel, it took time. And it took money. And even though it, you know, it may be just, you know, hay and a horse, you know, and whatever you can carry with you to keep you alive on the trail, on the campaign trail, it's just impossible for one person to be able to see and meet America. So the idea was that you would have an elector in every congressional district. And that elector would basically let everybody know against all the other electors. So there would be this network of wise men who were connected with the political apparatuses amongst the different states of those people that wanted to throw their name into the barrel, that they wanted to become president, that the electors would go look and say, okay, I like this person because I like their message. I like their platform. I like what they're doing. This is how Thomas Jefferson was able to unseat Adams from the presidency, because he challenged the administration as well as the current Congress with the Alien and Sedition Acts and successfully proved to America that the current administration and the current federal government was going in the wrong direction. And so, but instead of him actually proving to America, he used the electors out there to basically switch their loyalty to him instead of to Adams. This was the power of the Electoral College, because the people trusted, let's say, Billy Bob, you know, and Mary Sue. These were different electors in, you know, neighboring congressional districts, that they were the ones that constantly were trusted by the people on their judgment call of who was giving them the best bill of goods for the president. Now, in some cases, whether there's George Washington, it was just an easy deal. Whoever basically voted for George Washington, maybe the differentiator in the elector was who they were going to choose for vice president. And so they were kind of taking popularity cases at that point. But eventually, when, you know, the nation no longer knew the names of these people, it really came to this, you know, what is this person tangibly offering? Now, Andrew Jackson had a huge name when he threw his hat into the ring, because he was the guy that whooped the British butt down in New Orleans, down in Louisiana, right? And everybody knew. What's that? Go ahead.
That's our guy.
There you go. But he was America's guy because he actually kicked their butts. They made a song about him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was kind of immortalized. So he had that popularity, and it really wasn't back in boiling it down to issues, because America, and at that point, government wasn't involved in everybody's knickers. At least they didn't see it. They weren't sensing these deviations. Actually, there were very few, and as a matter of fact, that came out in reading some of Madison's letters, that in 1821, there were men that were questioning the direction of the federal government because of its unconstitutional decisions and actions by the federal government. You know, the Missouri Compromise and some of the Supreme Court rulings. They're saying, hey, you know, this is why they asked James Madison, and we'll get into this document and after we go through the Constitution. This was a letter from John G. Jackson asking James Madison for his notes on the Constitutional Convention. And Madison basically says, it doesn't matter what we thought the Constitution to mean to understand the Constitution. You have to go through the ratification debates, because it only matters how the states understood the Constitution at the time of ratification, because those are the legal definitions that they created the system with. It was what they basically understood, and they accepted the contract on those terms. That's the only thing that matters. And then all of a sudden, everybody starts seeing how Madison has been consistently pointing to this thing called contract law, and how the contract was bought into, or how it was sold so that the states bought into it. But everybody got dumbfounded, but I've gone down a couple of different rat holes. The whole point is about the Electoral College. The Electoral College was the one that brought the campaign to the people. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
And that's why, and the congressional districts, they would go out to the counties and say, I am an elector for, you know, this upcoming presidential race. I'm representing this person for president, this person for vice president, and their name, it would be their name that goes on the ballot. and you had to make sure that you chose that elector. Well, actually, it really, that was the system that was sold to America, but it took about 30 years, 40 years before they actually got to where the people were able to vote for their electors. Because some of the state legislatures just basically obscured this concept of the Electoral College, and the state legislatures would appoint who they wanted. And ultimately, as people started finding out that technically the president is supposed to be chosen by the people, that the people are supposed to choose their electors, and the electors choose the president, that's how it was sold. So if you look at the very back end of why counties matter most, we point out that it was like in the 1820s when more states and more states started allowing the people to choose their electors instead of appointing them. And by 1832, all but one state, I believe it was 1832, all but one state, it was South Carolina. South Carolina never let the people choose their electors all the way through the course of the Constitution. They either appointed them and or they finally handed it over to the parties in 1856. 1856 is when the beginning of the parties taking control of the Electoral College as well as control over political access to our government, where the parties literally control the political access. It's all unconstitutional. And the state legislatures have empowered the parties, and this is how they've created self-licking ice cream cone, where the people are completely unwise of this. As a matter of fact, show me where the primary is a constitutional election. It's not. It only became constitutional in one of the amendments. I think it was the poll tax. I think it was when we finally got to the poll tax. Because I don't think it's in the woman's suffrage in the 19. And let me go check real quick, because I don't think they mentioned primary in the 19th Amendment. When I look at the 19th Amendment, which is the right of women's, yep, it doesn't say anything regarding a primary. The primary didn't actually get mentioned into the Constitution, the primary election, until the poll tax, and that was the, I want to say it was the, was it the 23rd? No, the 24th? Yeah, the right of the citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election. So it was in 1962 when the primary was finally injected as a galvanized thing. But folks, let's look at this. The party has convinced the state, or the state legislatures have basically assumed to create this party-supporting election. In other words, the whole point of the primary is for the parties to weed down who they're going to have for their president, have your local electors and so forth. And every person in that state is paying the taxes to support that party election. All the independents, they shouldn't have to be paid for that. But every person, and the fact is most people aren't members of the party in that state. But they all vote for the party, and they've been bamboozled into believing that they have to have that primary. And folks, I'm here to tell you that if we got rid of the primary, we would actually be able to get rid of these shenanigans that they pull in all of these states where there are primaries. In the states where they basically, like in Wyoming, they allow voters to jump parties. And they do all these different shenanigans so that, they bypass the whole spirit of this protecting the party. But the question is, why is the taxpayers paying for an election that protects the party? When the fact of the matter is, when you look at the requirements of a House of Representatives, when you look at the requirements for a U.S. Senator, it doesn't say that you have to make it through a primary to have your name on that ballot. It says you have to be a citizen, and you have to be this years of age, and you have to be a citizen for this many years. That's it. And the states are actually creating parameters that say, oh, you also have to survive the party to get your name on that ballot. BS. That is an unconstitutional parameter that the Constitution, only the Constitution sets what the standards are for a U.S. senator. And the states have been getting away with actually taking away that from you. Oh, well, we're better off having less people. I disagree. You're better off having, a good election to where you either have a clear winner or you do what they call a runoff, where the top two or the top three go into another quick election. Or you're better off creating an electoral college for some of these things. Having a state electoral college would eliminate the need for that, because the electors or then the state house would then decide, like they do with the electoral college. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Imagine what would have happened if we didn't have the parties and primaries with RFK and Trump in this last election.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So basically what the parties did in 1856 was they assumed control over who would ultimately make it to that final election to ensure that the globalist guy will make it into office. And we've heard cases like with the Reagan presidency, when Reagan was going to basically extend his vice presidency in 1980, in the 1980 election, he was going to give it to Jack Kemp. And everybody knew that in the convention, the next day, Reagan was going to pull Jack Kemp onto the stage. Henry Kissinger went into a private meeting with Ronald Reagan and says, if you put Kemp on that stage, we will out him. We have pictures of him, and we will show what a corrupt man he is, and you will lose, and Jimmy Carter will win. Your only option is to choose George Herschel Walker Bush as your vice president. If you do that, you will win. And that's what happened. Reagan, go ahead.
Oh, I said I never liked that guy.
Who, Kissinger?
That's the one.
Yeah, Kissinger this guy was evil. I mean, he was the globalist manipulator in America. And everybody just, ooh, this guy really knows what he's talking about, because, all the governments are doing what he's saying. And I'm going, that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing, folks, because most of the things that they were doing, they weren't considering the Constitution. They weren't considering what was best for the world or for America. Anyway, it was, and as we know, and as it all turns out, George Herschel Walker Bush was compromised. He was already controlled. And as a matter of fact, he was in Dallas when John F. Kennedy was killed. He was an operative for the CIA. He became a director of the intelligence community before he became president. Here's a nobody that became this most powerful person over the United States intelligence apparatus. And I'm telling you, he wasn't a smart guy. Just like his son, George W. Bush, wasn't a smart guy. But, George W. Bush, I will just say this. He does have an exemplar life, because he doesn't have a security squad. He's constantly giving to Texas and so forth. I mean, he's trying to live kind of like Jimmy Carter. They're trying to live within their ideology that they feel is the right thing to do. But they were complete sellouts as presidents. They were complete sellouts. They did whatever the globalists needed them to do. And that's how it's been. John F. Kennedy obviously wasn't doing what the globalists wanted to do. Reagan wasn't doing what the globalists wanted to do. And the question is Trump doing what the globalists want to do? Because if he's not, they're going to take him. They're going to take a shot at him. I mean, they already tried to, but I honestly think that, they had somebody that was either incompetent with that shot or what have you, because it kind of helped galvanize Trump to gain momentum in the 2024 election, right?
Yes, sir.
That missed shot.
They meant it for
now, it could have been the divine hand of providence where he turned his head, where all of those types of things were that way. You know what I'm saying?
And that doesn't honor or place glory on Trump. That places glory on God for using him for his own purposes.
That's true, but only time will tell whether he's actually doing that. And, so we'll see. I honestly see, and we're really in a rat hole, because I've been on the record for this, I see Trump, because his initiative back in 2020, prior to him being defrauded out of that election, his initiative was to bring peace to Israel, to basically get the enemies of Israel to put down their arms, to actually broker the biblical peace that the Bible tells us that has to happen. Trump is trying to bring that to be. So who who's he serving? That's the, you know, I'll let you decide on that. But the interesting thing is, it's called the Abraham Accord.
Go look it up. Did you hear about the news today?
No. What's the news today?
They've agreed to the peace deal. He's going to Egypt to sign it.
Oh, with the Palestinians. Yep. With Hamas and these evil
things.
Yeah, but they've got to get all the rest of the Arab nations on board with this. And this is all going to happen.
Like eight now that are included in this.
I understand. So Iran and the rest of the nations, they all have to get on board with this. And I see it happening. I actually see it happening, which means, folks, that this has biblical ramifications. You can't say it doesn't. This has biblical ramifications. This is where we are. So I'll just say this so that we can get moving back to Article 2. Get right with God. Get right with God now. Because you need to start praying what you need to be doing in preparing for all of these times that the Great Bible has basically, you know, announced these are things that's going to happen. Anyway. So any other questions you have on the Electoral College before we get into the courts with Article 3?
No, I think the question was just about how the process works for them being selected within the states. Because like you said, when you go to vote, when the average person goes to vote, they just go click on the machine, the name they want, or mark, you know, push the button, whatever they're doing, and they have no idea how that process actually works.
Yeah, and the people.
That's why nobody paid attention when people were going, being sent to jail for being selected as electors and doing their job, and they're trying to put them in prison, you know, this last election.
So when we realize that we're not, it's a democracy when we're choosing the president, that the system was designed that smarter people would understand. Because it's not just choosing the president, it's choosing the vice president. The electors are to decide who's to be what, not the party. And the party has basically turned it over to a popularity contest. Whoever wins the presidential, you know, nomination, then they get to choose their own vice president. How constitutional is that? It flies in the face of the Constitution, folks. Right, wrong, or indifferent, you may love the outcome, you know, in 2020. You may love the outcome in 2024. I am telling you the only outcome we should be accepting is that the constitutional one, because that means that America is going to win and the globalists don't. Because I'm going to guess those people that were happy with 2020, they weren't happy with 2024 and vice versa. And the bottom line is, the only reason we've been tossed to and fro is because we've just been manipulated. And I think that it helped galvanize, you know, this momentum that Trump has, which is one of the reasons I say throw caution in everything you're seeing today, because these aren't just things that seem to be happening in the small little chasm. These are things that have global and biblical ramifications. Okay. Now, Article 3 of the Constitution is where we actually dive into the Supreme Court and its roles and responsibilities and this ambiguous power. Now, when we talk about government power, it may be their roles and responsibilities, technically. It's when we talk about government power, we talk about government sovereignty. And when you go through the ratification debates, which we did these past few months, it was clear that the only sovereigns within the federal government is Congress, because they have the power to make law, get rid of law, and, you know, tax us. Those types of things is the true power of government, when they can oppress you. The courts only made decisions. And when we go through Article 3, as we went through the ratification debates, you can clearly see, and we're going into a break right now. So when we come back from break, we'll dive into Article 3. But as going through Article 3, we're going to find out, you know, the limitations of the jurisdiction. They don't have this open-armed, you know, jurisdiction over everything under the sun that we believe that they do. They're not the final arbiters. And we're academically stating that case through everything we're presenting. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we get into Article 3. And so Section 1 kind of lays out what we'll call not the power, but the metaphorical image of the federal court system. Now, going through the ratification debates, folks, do not forget that the Constitution never declared common law to be the law of the land, which was problematic in every single one of the states where it was vigorously debated. But the delegates where it wasn't vigorously debated, I think it was kind of clear that the federal government had no power to meddle within the governing and the legal systems of the state. The federal government was designed to be able to interface with the state's legal system and basically support it in the capacity because it was a supporting entity. The federal government was to support the states individually and as a union. It wasn't the other way around. This is why when we get into the Federalist Papers, you'll find that what Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers directly conflict with how the ratifications of the Constitution or how the judiciary very specifically was sold to the states. It's a passive system to support the states. Its jurisdiction was limited. Even Madison stated that more than 90% of all the cases that are occurring in the state would never see the light of day in the federal court, because they don't fall under the jurisdiction, or they do not arise, these matters don't arise under the Constitution within their jurisdiction. So let's start off with Section 1, and let's look at this persona that is being created with this federal court. Go ahead.
Article 3, Section 1, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior.
Okay, hold on.
Shall,
forgive me. I'll probably interrupt you when we have these little highlights every once in a while, but it's okay. I mean, I'd rather have it disheveled a little bit, you're surprised, than, you know, letting it go, because during good behavior has been constitutionally modified by the 14th Amendment, Section 3 specifically. In other words, it's no longer good behavior, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says if a judge fails to support the Constitution and they induce a ruling that is not in direct support of the Constitution, or they open their doors in jurisdiction or assume jurisdiction over something that does not arise under the Constitution, and they hear that case, they have violated their oath. And Section 3 basically states, and again, this is a huge message for President Trump. Section 3 basically states that the courts can be equally accountable. That's why it states the federal judges and the state judges. We've gone through this, folks. The only people that are not accountable to Section 3, because they're accountable to a very specific impeachment process within the Constitution, See, in 1866, the radical Republicans realized that these little comments like good behavior and basically, you know, controlling the decorum and determining whether they expel a member or not, they realized that it was honor among thieves in each of these institutions, in the Senate, the House, and the federal court systems. And they said no more. They said that if you're under oath and you violate that oath by failing to support the Constitution, you have committed moral perjury and must be removed. And therefore, that's exactly what they implemented, was the process to say, not only are you ineligible, you are to be banned from ever participating in an office of public trust or public profit, period. What does public profit mean? Any ideas? Any ideas?
I would surmise that it has something to do with commerce and creating economy.
Okay. And actually, I'll let you Google it.
It's the public.
I'll let you Google it. But the way I see it, because government, our government isn't profit-based. Our government is service-based. In other words, our public servants are to actually serve and support the Constitution. So I believe public profit means that you are taking on a role within your state. Now, remember, there's no such thing as federal commerce. The federal government does not have the ability to establish a federal company that will operate in all the states. Each state has control over their own commerce within the state. And ergo, the Commerce Clause literally states that the federal government will have the power to regulate commerce among the states, not within them. We already covered that in Article 1, Section 8. So when we look at what is public profit, that means somebody operating within the state as a corporation or as a business making money. In other words, this literally makes it so that you can't be, it's one thing as a household to, you know, have your own farm and sell your own goods, you know, but it's not, it's different when you're in the business arena where you actually have employees and so forth. And so they wanted to remove corruption from government and from the public arena, which is why I believe public profit means it's speaking to businesses that are operating under the license of the state. In other words, you don't, for you to capture your milk and to sell it in the market, you don't have to have a license. For you to grow food on your land, you're not to have a license. You're, that's your land, and you have the right of commerce to survive and live on your own without government intervention. When you get into manufacturing and employees and so forth, then you have to get an agreement or however the state wants to set up the management of businesses, as long as you've delegated that power in the Constitution for the state to regulate, to allow business, the creation of businesses and to regulate them. Because you got to give them that power, right? Okay, so we have enumerated constitutions. We need to make sure that the state has the of legitimate authority to do these things. If not, then they can't even regulate commerce. And so these positions of profit, the public profit, would basically be it wouldn't exist in these other states if they don't have the ability to regulate them. And I would think that it would be important that that got fixed. But nevertheless, I believe public profit is somebody that's operating a business within the state. What does it say? How do they define public profit?
Public profit, I told it specific public profit. It's not a standard legal or economic doctrine like the public trust, but it generally refers to financial gains derived by public or publicly regulated entities, or more broadly, to the idea of profit within sectors that serve the public interest.
Okay, so let me actually go into, no person shall be or engage.
Secretary or something like that.
Yeah, so they don't mention public profit or trust in this. Interesting, so okay. I don't see public profit or trust. So an offer of the United. Okay, so they. I believe. Let me do this. Public trust. Let me just look for the trust.
There's a definite fiduciary tone to the public trust definition.
Yeah, so that's in Article 4, an office or public trust under the United States. So that right there is when you're, you know, operating as the Treasury, where you actually have fiduciary responsibilities. So there's public trust, but public profit. Let me look up public profit, if there's such a thing. P-R-O-F-I-T. And no, it doesn't arise under the Constitution. What about just profit, period? And so, forgive me, folks, but yeah, trust or profit under them. So this is actually in the 13th Amendment, and there's four uses of trust. And this is what it says in the 13th Amendment of 1812. It says, and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them within the states. So there include profit there. Let me see here. The next one, trust or profit, is in Section 3 of the first article. In other words, they do. So what is public profit? Office of profit or trust? Trust or profit?
Are they talking about the fact that they get paid
yes,
for their office?
I think so. I think that this is actually, yeah, when they talk about trust and profit, I believe that this is where they actually have the ability to write the check. The ability to actually spend the money on the public behalf. And I believe that that right there is, it's not necessarily directly tied to Section 3. So I stand corrected, because when you look at Section 3, it basically says anybody that is under oath and they fail, they're gone. And they are basically barred from being in public office ever again, unless it is removed by two-thirds of both houses, as we pointed out before. So anyway, let's get back into Article 3, Section 1, and this is where we talked about good behavior. And to be clear, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment literally took that and wiped that out. Now, it doesn't mean that a judge can't be expelled because they're basically, an adulterer, because that's bad behavior, or they are drunk all the time. You know, that's bad behavior. It doesn't mean that they're violating their oath of office, right? There's a difference. So the good behavior still can be a play in removing a judge, but if they violate their oath, then Section 3 is mandated to kick in, and they are to be removed, period. You do not follow the other process of bad behavior. Violating the oath, gone immediately. Removed from office, removed from the position, gone and banned. Gone and banned. Okay. So pick it up from the Section 3 cut-in.
And shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation, which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office.
Okay. And they covered all of this in the Constitutional Convention, why they wanted to make sure that, you know, if the government or if the people, you know, were unhappy with these people who were in office, they couldn't financially hurt them, because that wouldn't be fair. It's one thing to remove them, but to financially hurt them by diminishing their salary, they wanted to make sure that that couldn't happen. And bottom line, even when it increased, they had, for the elected, their pay could only increase after they were reelected. But with judges, that was a perpetual position. I'm here to say, folks, we need to remove perpetual positions for judges, period. That you have a term and you're going to be out, because it's only proven that when we give judges this perpetual protection, they actually start behaving badly. And I believe that it doesn't mean that they will, but often they behave badly. And getting rid of them, and I'm not a fan of what we call term limits, but I am a fan, because what does the judge really do? He's not representing anybody. He's supposed to be representing the Constitution. and or representing the state and the state's interest regarding that constitution. In other words, making sure that the state interests aren't marginalized in the cases and the verdicts to basically assume power for the federal government, because this is where we actually see those conflicts actually occur, where the federal courts are basically trampling on state rights wherever they can get away with it. And so bottom line, we want to make sure that everybody's aware Section 3 is equally applicable to the federal Supreme Court and below. Now, Section 2, this is where they get into the jurisdiction, this section right here. Go ahead.
Section 2, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority.
There we go. Okay, so right there after authority is a semicolon, which in other words, that very first two lines of the Constitution, that is their jurisdiction parameters. In other words, it extends to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. Now, isn't it interesting that it says this Constitution? How did they know that there would be another Constitution created? I don't think they knew. But so why use this Constitution? I honestly think that that's more of providence. I think that that's something that actually speaks to a greater knowledge that eventually there would be a contention between the literal language of the Constitution and eventually where the court assumes their own authority over the Constitution. Folks, if you understand the annotated Constitution, it is the Constitution as the courts have bent it based on their rulings and decisions of how they interpret the Constitution. Now, there's nowhere in this Constitution that gives the courts that authority. We're reading it right now. And folks, listen to see if the courts have the ability to change or redefine anything within this Constitution, to literally take the Constitution and make up what they believe is the best interpretation for the modern era. In other words, the living Constitution or the annotated Constitution is an abomination in this republic. And this is the document, or this living Constitution is what they use in the court system and in our legal system and in government today. How did that happen? Well, it all goes back to the courts assuming powers and roles and responsibilities that they have no jurisdiction over. So let's continue. Now, there's this next step. And as a matter of fact, you see this long dash, and then it has this one step, semicolon, and another long dash. Technically, if you take Section 2 right here, and you make this subsection 1, right, and this is the hard jurisdiction, then you would literally put 1 as the top, subsection 1, and then the next one would be subsection 2, which is what you're going to read, and then subsection 3, because they're breaking it down into these very specific castes. So let's go ahead and read the next one to the dash or to the semicolon.
To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and councils.
And so this means that the diplomatic class that is going to be a part of the federal government, that is going to be engaging with foreign nations, or foreign nations engaging with the United States in the United States, the Supreme Court will have jurisdiction over any matters or controversies that come under this class of governing or people. Next one.
The controversies to which the United States shall be a party.
So actually, you get the next to all cases.
Oh, I skipped one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
I lost my place.
That's all right.
I was making notes.
It's okay. It's okay.
To all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction.
Okay, so admiralty and maritime jurisdiction is federal now. And prior to the Supreme, or prior to the Constitution, into the Articles of Confederation, the Articles of Confederation didn't have a judiciary. And the states actually were playing their own game in making their own treaties and playing with other nations. And in so effect, the states were actually engaging in admiralty and maritime cases because they had the advantage of doing that. And now the federal courts or under this constitution, because all commerce, international commerce and all treaty agreements with other foreign nations are federal. In other words, no state can now create their own treaties. So they assume now jurisdiction over those agreements. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So now the states have just lost some power. They realize that they're not going to be able to have their own special brokerage with foreign nations at the disadvantage of other states, meaning Virginia, New York, and these big, powerful commerce states, Massachusetts, and maybe even Pennsylvania. Those were the top four, if I remember correctly. They were the ones that had the advantages, and Virginia was at the top of that. And they realize that by this line right there and by the treaty and everything else, the states are literally losing this bargaining advantage. This is why Virginia went all guns a-blazing at the Constitution and attacking it. They did not want to give up that top spot, you know, in the Union. That makes sense, right? And so yes, they created this argument, a facade. We need a Bill of Rights. We've got to get this Bill of Rights. And so we can't pass this because we don't have a Bill of Rights. Had they been honest and said, hey, look, we have this huge advantage in this system that we have, and we're going to be knocked off the top peg if we get into this. That would have been a genuine and honest position. But they knew that if they did that they would lose, because it was about what is a better government, us being the tyrants of the Union or us becoming a part of the Union. There you go. And they knew that they couldn't win that argument. So what do you do? Well, I tell you what, you kind of have to eat a little bit of crow, you know, and say we need to conform to this new system. Patrick Henry was literally, he kept on pointing to the Constitution and this government to be created. That's a brand new government. It's a new system, folks, and you can't trust it. I mean, he was taking all these oblique approaches in attacking the Constitution of the federal government. But the reality is this, the federal government only had these very specific powers. He knew that they, you know, the lust and avarice is always ever omnipotent and present in people in government, that they will always try to get outside those bounds. But he was wrong when he said that they would, under the Constitution, be able to do those things. Everything he assumed, everything he asserted that they would do would be direct violations of the Constitution. Now, they may do it because they can bamboozle or they buy their way through it, but it's still a violation. And that's why the Federalists were winning the argument to say, you know, what you're stating is literally something that is contrary to what that line means. They can't do that. And if they do, they're violating their oath. And so this is one of the reasons why even in the biggest state, the most powerful state, even Virginia got across that finish line in ratifying the Constitution. And that was amazing. The fact that New Hampshire wanted to take a back seat for a short period of time, because New Hampshire actually met twice. They met once, and when Massachusetts was in the process of ratifying, they basically said, you know what, we want to suspend what we're doing. We don't want to not ratify, but we want to suspend our position at this point, and we want to wait for better days, because New Hampshire, February, it's kind of harsh winter, you know, it's harsh conditions, right? So they chose to reconvene in the summertime. And so in June, when they were reconvening, enough came forward. Now, when you read all the letters and you read all the I'll just say these little arguments of, oh, you know, the anti-federalists really had the strong position to go to the mat and to actually, you know, kill the Constitution in New Hampshire, that New Hampshire would not be the ninth pillar. And what that means is the first state that ratified, which was Delaware, they were the first pillar. And every state that joined became the next pillar. They were going to be like the fourth or fifth pillar, and they chose to wait. So when they came up, they became the ninth pillar. And the real question was, were they going to ratify or not? And everybody that was reading the tea leaves was wrong. As a matter of fact, when they went into convention, it was done. And even though everybody thought that the anti-federalists had the position, the argument actually came out. And unfortunately, we don't have what that argument was. But they convened and they were done in a week. When the first convention, they were arguing for a couple of weeks. And so, unfortunately, we don't have all the things that they had in their debates. The University of Wisconsin has it. And there's all this huge speculation of, you know, that New Hampshire was really going to be the first one that went against the Constitution, but they didn't. And what ended up happening was they rubber stamped it in June. Hamilton heard, and I forget where I learned this, but I know Eldridge Gerry, who was very close to the folks in New Hampshire, because they were kind of relatives, because many of the people that created New Hampshire were kicked out of Massachusetts. So there was this, you know, this relationship between those two states, and Eldridge Gerry heard that New Hampshire was going to rubber stamp it. And that's when Hamilton took the pen to paper in creating these last eight Federalist Papers, folks. And that's why on the 14th of June, the first Federalist Paper dropped while they were literally ratifying the Constitution in New Hampshire. Now, remember, the distance between New York City and up in New Hampshire, I think it was Concord, New Hampshire, where they were convening, there was no way Hamilton really knew this. He was basically living off of this preposition that Eldridge Gerry told him that they were going to rubber stamp it. And he basically took that to the bank. And within a day or two after that publication, or after he wrote that, I don't even think it was published. After he wrote that, he got news that they did ratify. And then the next one, and the next one, and the next one. Then he got very vigorous in writing the last of the Federalist Papers. That just shows you how underhanded he was in writing these things that would actually empower the judiciary in a direct conflict of the language of the Constitution as well as the language of the ratification debates, that the courts could not do those things. So I get off my soapbox. We've got 14 seconds. I really thank you for participating, Sean, in doing this. We'll come back to the controversies between two or more states and so forth, because that's where we kind of left off in our next show. Any other parting questions real quick?
No, sir. But I was curious. You said that occurrence you just talked about, it's very interesting considering that he was like, okay, it's sealed. Now I can start working on usurping it.
Manipulating it. Absolutely.
That's the idea I got.
Yep, absolutely. Yes, he was a scoundrel. Hamilton was a very devious man. And as a matter of fact, in the article I'm writing on this, it actually exposes Hamilton's position, even in the Constitutional Convention, how he hated what they were doing in creating the Constitution, how he thought differently. And so all of this is going to be in that article. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flow chart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.